Good morning. So, recently, some of my students had a revelation about me. They were like, Mr. Me, you have a beard? And I'm like, have we been wearing these that much? I guess the answer is yes. I'm a little nervous. I never do this. I never stand in front of people and talk to them. I actually do that most days. But I am overprepared. I actually just found it easier to type it all out, but I resolved to myself that I wasn't going to just read it. I read it to Nick, though, and he gave it a 5-star review. So I'm going to start reading a little bit, and then I'm just going to do my best to not, because that's not how I tell my students to present, you know. Sometimes they do anyways. They kind of turn and start reading. That's not good. All right. Good morning. So, I'm not a preacher, and you're a little bit disappointed. Now, I imagine this doesn't come as a surprise to you. I was tempted to pretend that I am, to preach the way a preacher ought to preach. But no. but you know, I had a little over a month to prepare, and I don't know, I never got that sense from God. I instead got this sense that I should just share from who I am. And kind of to paraphrase C.S. Lewis, you know, I'm standing here today as more of an act of comparing notes with you. Isn't that a nice image? Comparing notes after the latest lecture from our rabbi, Jesus. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just kind of approach it from that angle as far as, well, how can I bless you from what I've gotten from God? And not as a preacher, but my day job is a teacher. And I really just hope that it will be that way. So, I have the unique privilege of talking to many people in the next generation. For those of you who don't know, I teach high school here at Sturgis, and this year I teach all seniors, which means I teach some children and some adults. But that's a story for another day. No. But I've come to realize just what an awesome responsibility it is to teach them as well. That these are people who will be part of our society and making important decisions someday. And here I am pouring into them. And I have to admit that also there's a hard part to it, especially, I guess, for me, I feel like this terrible burden of stuffing my Christianity behind a mask. Not this one. And I teach at a secular school, and so it's kind of the sense that, you know, my religion is somewhere, and it's not spoken in the building very much. And that's, I'm okay with that, but it is, it's just a part of my job. And I kind of imagine, honestly, it's a part of a lot of people's jobs. The difference is I talk a lot with these people. So most days, I don't resent that at all. And on the days where I do, I think I've heard the instructions of our God. When he spoke to Samuel so very long ago, in 1 Samuel 8, 7, he says, "And the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." And what does that mean? Well, in the original context, it of course meant Samuel was feeling pretty insulted because he felt the people were rejecting him, a judge, for a king. But God was reminding him that in reality, they were rejecting him, the God king, for a man king. And this is a common theme throughout history. You know, we've seen a lot of times where that happens. And I don't know, sometimes in a cultural context, I find that a little hard. So I kind of want to share a little bit about that with you, because while I am not a person who has any social media, I interact socially with people all the time. And I found that just in doing this, that's where it made the most sense to go, just to share a little bit from my heart. And of course, not just my heart, but really my heart in submission to God, my heart in submission to Jesus. So that's where I want to take it. All right. And I guess I want to point out that, you know, God has handled rejection from people for a very, very long time. And while I might not be self-confident enough or secure enough to really handle that very well, God is. And as I was preparing, you know, I just thought, well, what do we see? Where do we see God doing that? And I'm going to zip through a few verses, and then there'll be a couple chunks where we kind of end up staying there a little longer. But I just want to, you know, kind of synthesize a few pieces here. But in Matthew 23, verse 37, you see Jesus looking at Jerusalem and just kind of speaking with a heart of compassion in response to just their rejection of him in a lot of ways. And he says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing." And I just think, wow, that's such a beautiful image. You know, God, in response to the rejection of his people, was saying, "Oh, I just wanted to gather you under my wing, keep you safe, hold you close." That's the God we serve. I love that. All right, what? Returning to the circumstances of my own job, I also want you to know that I don't feel like I'm being dishonest in my job, even though I have to kind of lay aside what I would consider the most important part of me, right? I'm a Christian first, then a teacher. Well, no, Christian, you know, then husband, father, all of those things. And eventually, somewhere down the line, teacher. But my students don't see that. But I'm not ashamed of the gospel, and I'm mostly eager to talk about Jesus. But I've learned that I can be both genuine to my students and honestly obey the law, that is. I may not be able to speak my Christianity, but I am able to act it. And I think that's important. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I guess it means something like this. When you see people 5 days a week, you're bound to see people both at their best and at their worst. You might not be, or you might be, I don't know, surprised how many times I've just seen people just straight up cry right in front of me. It's not a normal aspect of a job, I think. We'll see teenagers cry in front of you. But, you know, it happened actually on Friday. So there you go. But I appreciate that because this is what I think it does. You know, in the Bible it says, you know, rejoice with those who are rejoicing and tell the gospel to those who are weeping. That's not actually what it says, right? It says, you know, weep with those who are weeping. And of course the gospel is very important there, but what I love about it is it's let me see humans in so many different contexts. And you get to, when you hang out 5 days a week with the same person over and over, you get to see just how much of an individual they are. And that's, I think it's just a little taste, a little shadow of what God sees in everyone. So that's what I want to kind of share from, this awareness of that. And this awareness that sometimes culturally, I think we're bound to kind of zoom out and start talking about ideas and stop talking about people. And well, certainly, I talk ideas like almost every day, like it's two people, it's four people. And, you know, I wonder sometimes if we deserve the privilege of sharing something as sacred as the gospel with another human being, if we don't in that very moment care about that person. You know, it's not about, in my opinion, making sure we our idea is the biggest, that the gospel is bigger than anyone else's idea, that we are accepted by everyone else. No, the gospel is a salve and a bandage for a lost and broken world. But it's even more personal than that, right? The gospel is relief from the excruciating experience of being lost to a person, to you and to me, and so hopefully to many, many others who don't know it yet, right? That's the kind of perspective that I wish I always had on me. And I just appreciate that I kind of got this time to put it on a page and just hopefully have this tucked in the back of my mind as I go and work with a lot of people who don't always share the same views as me. All right. Now, that's basically my introduction. I forgot one key part, and that's the title of this sermon. The title of the sermon is, You're the Weirdo. And I want you to know, my wife recommended that be the title of this sermon, and Pastor Eric might have had his hand in that as well. So that's kind of called the hook. Now you can't stop listening because you want to know. Who's the weirdo? What is this weirdo? What are we talking about? Are you allowed to say weirdo in the pulpit? Like, is that okay? Let's find out. All right. So that's my introduction. And as an English teacher, I ask myself, what's my thesis? What's my point that I want to carry through this half? Oh, I don't even have a timer. Look at that. You know what Pastor Eric would say. It's like free reign. How many pages can I add to this before the end? But we'll just stick with half hour. I like have no idea what. Anyways. Okay, thesis. All right, here's my thesis. In my own heart, I have struggled with the feeling that our culture has been pulled out from beneath my feet. I have felt, quite frequently sometimes, that I am on the losing team. And I know Pastor Eric talked about that. I really appreciate that sermon, you know. Let's be losers, like, yes, let's do it. And I'm tempted to be angry about this sometimes. I'm drawn to fight. I pick up the sword of, not truth, but frustration. I strap on the shield of, not faith, but dogma. But this is to my shame, for as it says in Hebrews 11:6, and without faith, it is impossible to please him, that is God, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. Beloved, we don't fight against the world. We fight for the world. Why? Because God is. And because of what he's done for us. That's quite extraordinary, I know. Okay, where do I go from here? I suppose I could just be done, but no, actually, here's the way I've structured it. And I actually went through a couple iterations of this, which is sad because it just means I spent way too long preparing. I thought to myself, I probably spent 10 hours preparing for 30 minutes. If I did that for my average lessons, I would never sleep. So you guys get the special extra deluxe, ultra prepared sermon as opposed to my students who get the, ooh, let's put something together real quick, and done. But here's the way I'm gonna structure it. I'm a good teacher, I promise. Here's the way I structured it. I realized that there's some phrases that I hear fairly often in a secular setting. And to be honest, sometimes my first impression is kind of frustration. But I just really appreciate that I kind of found the space, God gave me the space to take a step back and say, wait a second, let's actually look at those. Let's hold these phrases up to God's light and see what comes out. All right, so I have two phrases for you from just I've heard them in our culture. And I'm kind of hoping that you've heard them. Otherwise, you might be like, what's he talking about? But let me tell you, these are things that float around in society. I know, because I'm hanging out there. And so, next page. All right. So here's the first phrase. How many of you have heard the phrase, you do you? Okay, I'm getting some nods, a little bit of that. Okay, good. Teenage nods. That's really good because that's who I hang out with mostly. So, and you know what? I've had a bit of time to think about that phrase, you do you. And I've come to a couple conclusions. All right. Firstly, the phrase, you do you, is a cliche. And as a cliche, I don't actually like it. It's meant to stop conversation. And to be honest, it's a pretty potent way for an individual to stop the gospel. It says, your gospel sounds great and all, but that's for you. This road over here, that leads a very different place is for me. This cliche kind of just makes it really hard to say, no, the gospel saves your life. The gospel changes everything. It's not you do you. We need God, each and every one of us. And I think it's just kind of rooted in an apathy that says freedom is worth more than your own soul. I disagree. But as a phrase, apart from its cliche meaning, I was surprised. I think it actually shows us two important things that Christians can and ought to celebrate. Firstly, that God has made each of us to be unique. By some miracle that I can't rightly understand, holiness is not at all homogeneous. I think of Jesus saying in John 10, verse 14, I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And then here's the part that kind of drew my attention. And I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there'll be one flock and one shepherd. I think it's good to remember how many of us are Gentiles who are not despised for being Gentiles. I also think of Paul, who tells us that we are one body, but we are many organs, each uniquely serving. Paul wrote it this way, originally in Greek, mind you. And this here, I got a bigger chunk, so if you want, you're welcome to follow me into 1 Corinthians 12. By the way, Bible Gateway, such a nice function of modern life. Being able to say, oh, I remember this piece, but where is it again? What did they do 200 years ago? Probably they read their Bibles a whole bunch more while they were looking for that. That's not a bad thing, I suppose. But I do like to appreciate technology when I find you can appreciate it. So, for just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in one spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one spirit. And I love that unifying piece here. I'm kind of interjecting my thoughts here. I love that the UDU, where it unravels, is that we need to be unified. Something must reconcile everything. His name is Jesus. But even so, coming back to verse 14. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the sense of hearing? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them, as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. Officially ruffle some papers, okay. Isn't that beautiful? I just think, wow, looking at the phrase, you do you, from that light, makes me not quite so frustrated about it, I suppose. Makes me kind of appreciate that God needs teachers, and then he needs a whole bunch of other people. I mean, here I am standing up here, but I'm just one person, and I think that it's important for you to share from what God has assigned me to be. And I think it's also important for you guys to share from what God has assigned you to be. He made us wonderfully, wonderfully unique. All right. I just have to throw this one in here, okay? To be honest, it also makes me think of the very end of the book of John. I don't know, something about that part I really like. It also, no, I'll get to it in a minute. I do that to my students all the time. I'm like about to say something, I'm like, this way instead. In John chapter 21, this is what we read. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. That's John. the one who also had leaned back against him during the supper and said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So the saying spread among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. But Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but "if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" And this is what it reminds me of. It reminds me of something else from C.S. Lewis. I'm a very big C.S. Lewis fan. Chronicles of Narnia, Edmund goes off the beaten track, gets captured by the queen, gets rescued by the sacrifice of Aslan. But at this point, Edmund gets rescued, and you see off in the distance, I have even the picture of it, of the movie, which, you know, read the books too, Aslan talking to Edmund. And it's too far. You don't get to hear what he says. And Peter and Susan come out, and Aslan and Edmund stop talking, and Aslan comes over, and they're like, "What did you guys say?" And Aslan's basically like, "That's not your business. I was talking to Edmund. Sometimes I talk to you, sometimes I talk to Edmund." And I get that sense right here. Peter's like, "What about him? What deal does he get?" And Jesus says, "That's actually not your business. You follow me." I just love that. You know, just this, what does it really say? It says that God is deeply invested in your individuality and everyone else's. So, you know, sometimes I think we need a little bit of that rebuke. Stop wondering what everyone else gets or should get. Stop being frustrated by what others are doing or you think ought to be doing. You follow me. So, I just think that's a beautiful picture. All right. But I also want to kind of zoom out just a little bit, and I want to observe something else in this phrase, "you do you." Okay, we've kind of seen that "you do you" can kind of acknowledge the individuality of a person, but then we do become societies. And that's where I think it's also interesting to look at. And I've already pointed out some of my objections, but here I'm holding it up again to the light of God to see what pops out. So I think also, what a grace of God that we don't have to get culture right. I've heard many times the idea lauded that we ought to imitate the early church. And for the most part, I very much agree. The only problem is I can't speak Greek or Hebrew or any of those ancient languages for that matter. Nor do I know the cultural practices of the time and place. I would stick out like a clown in a bunch of, like in a, where all the monks hung out. I would be the clown. I was actually going to find a picture to illustrate this, you know, put it up on the board, like one clown and a whole bunch of monks right around it, just so you could see how ridiculous it would be. But apparently that doesn't exist on Google. I was shocked. Like, I thought Google had everything. Apparently not. If you find one, I guess, I don't know, show me or just, that should not be your takeaway from this sermon. But just take a moment and imagine that, all right? I want you to just kind of picture this ancient medieval, we'll go medieval, you know, the stonework, this beautiful monastery, and all the monks are singing their Gregorian chant. And then you kind of pan down the line, and they're sitting in their pews, and they're praying very fervently to God. Monk, 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 you the clown, monk, monk, monk. And they all look around and like, "Who's that guy?" That's you. You're probably like, "Oh, this is definitely where Mr. Me," which is my students call me, you can call me Dylan, of course. "This is definitely where he got the title for the sermon, 'You're the Weirdo.'" Amazingly, it's not. We'll get there. But it is a silly picture, but I think it's important It's important that we don't fool ourselves thinking that the way we do church is the way we'll do it in heaven. And I guess, to make my point, you think we're going to have these in heaven? Vacuum sealed. You could take these anywhere. Straight from God's door. But we don't have to, right? We do very much have this, and we do very much need this. We do very much need to follow God. But what a grace that the way we dress, the way we speak, what we speak, the way we comport ourselves, the hand gestures we use, the hairstyles we have, that doesn't matter. What a grace of God. I think they got a little bit hung up on that in the Old Testament, that we needed to be very particular about our culture, otherwise God will reject us. But okay, now let's get to the, where did I get this you're the weirdo thing? And I promised Pastor Eric, actually, I guess I didn't promise it so much as he said, Dylan, I think you should preach and this should be your starting point. I'm like, really? This is a very odd starting point. So I have to draw you back to the conversation that originated it. And so this is, I'm going to read a little bit here. So to illustrate, I'm going to use a conversation that I had with Pastor Eric not all that long ago. And for full transparency, I will admit that it's actually the prompt that I was given for this very sermon. And I will also admit that it's not like I was recording my conversation. So what you get is a remembered transcript of it. Here's how it went. So there I was, sitting across from Pastor Eric, talking about the deep things of life. We were sitting in the daily paper, enjoying a little breakfast and a lot of conversation. So tell me a little about your brother's church, Pastor Eric said. And I did my best to describe a church that I very much respect. A church so ordinary, so 21st century, and yet deeply faithful. Then Pastor Eric said something about the ancient faith. And I thought, what a great phrase. I find it comforting. Like leather, or wood, or ancestral homes, or an old hymn. Old can very often mean something bad, tired, worn out, and outdated, tattered, and forgotten. But I don't know about you. I think that what is ancient kind of invokes this feeling that we should very much respect our elders. And something about the phrase just struck a spark in my brain. And I said, oh, that reminds me of what I was reading last night. I was reading 1 Samuel when the Philistines take the Ark of the Covenant. And I have to tell you that sometimes I think Judges and Samuel are some of the most difficult books to read in the Bible. At this point, Pastor Eric interjected and said, yes, indeed, well, with the genocide and whatnot. I don't think Pastor Eric actually said whatnot. I just don't remember specifically what he said. Exactly, I said. But it's more than just that. You read it and you suddenly realize that it sounds kind of like a folktale. I mean, the Philistines are consulting sorcerers and mystics to figure out how to return the ark, which has been giving them all these plagues, and they have to make these like golden tumors. You just imagine, you know, ordering from a factory, I'd like a golden tumor, please. And it's like, whoa, did they do that? Well, it's recorded. So I feel pretty confident, yeah. But if you think about it, that time period is at least as long as our modern age so far. We think that everything we have built up is normal, the right way to do it. Then the new way is better. We think we're normal and everyone else, everywhere else, has funny accents. And this is where we're going to get to the meat of it right here. Not really, because anyways. Sometimes I just, and this is me speaking to Pastor Eric, sometimes I just wish I could say to such a modern person, someone who doesn't simply see Christianity as irrelevant to them, but just plain irrelevant. I wish I could say to them, one day, either by your death or by the end of the ages, you'll be drawn to a great hall bigger than you've ever seen. And you'll look all about you and you'll realize that everyone who has ever lived is there. And at the end of the hall, there's a person so resplendently shining, so radiant in power and glory that you can't even tell the color of his skin. Around you on your left and on your right are people of every age and place and tribe and tongue. Then, in that moment, you'll realize that everything you've thought up and built up and lived in are just castles of sand, and that in the face of eternity, you're the weirdo. That's actually what I said. Like, those words slipped out of my mouth. I'm like, phew. And I'll admit, it was not the most eloquent word choice, weirdo. I think it might have drawn a chuckle from Pastor Eric. But it is honestly the words that came out of my mouth. And to be honest, like, maybe it came out a little bit frustrated, right? No, you're the weirdo. I mean, I don't even know if I'd let my son say that. Probably not. Certainly not in a frustrated way. But I thought about that in kind of response to some of the things that I hear that just kind of are a little hard to take sometimes. Like, I've literally heard people say religion is whack, or, you know, Christianity, like, you know, nobody believes in that stuff anymore. And I'm kind of thinking to myself, like, or, you know, Christianity, that's like a cult now, right? Like, these are things that people think. It's a little frustrating. But you know what? Someday we'll all be a little bit humbled, because I think that while I kind of meant it to the person who doesn't think anything of Christianity, what will they see when they see Jesus? I realize something else. What will we think when we see Jesus? I think a little bit we're going to think, I'm not dressed properly. And the Bible actually has something to say about that. Look at this. This is maybe to me the heart of it all right here. Revelation chapter 7, verse 9. After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands. Haste the day, right, that we can see that. But not just see that, to be there. And I hope, because I know it will be so much better, that it feels a little bit weird to me. Because it's going to be not at all what I could even possibly imagine. But let's just think about that for a second. You know, every tribe and every tongue, every tribe and every tongue covered in white robes. And those white robes, I think, are very, very important. I think if the culture of heaven were to be presently described to us, it might best be described as white robes. And you know, you have to remember that parable Jesus said, which I did not put in my notes, so I'm sorry I can't give you that. But the one where he invites everybody to the wedding party, and the first group doesn't show up, and then the second group shows up, and they're the ones that are there. There's that little part on the end, the person who shows up at the party without the wedding gown, and he says, "Where did you come from?" And he has no answer, and so the master of the house says, "Make this one leave." Those white robes are very, very important. We need God's grace to be in his presence. So there you have it. You're the weirdo. Don't be embarrassed. Put on the white robe. Pick up a palm branch. See who stands at the end of the hall. It seems impossible, but he will reconcile all things, all of our differences, both individual and societal, will be reconciled by him. That gives me so much hope. All right, so that's one, and if that clock's right, I still have plenty of time. But I said only two, so here we go, number two. So here's the second phrase, and you tell me, have you ever heard this one? Speak truth to power. Have you heard that one? I have definitely heard that one. I'll just leave it at that. So I've had quite a few conversations about truth recently. This is probably something to do with the fact that I teach a course called Theory of Knowledge. And, you know, I got my students to be like, wait, what does truth even mean? And it's like, now we're going to have a good conversation today. But in this context, or like right this instant, I want to point out I'm using kind of a lowercase t truth. We can definitely, we'll just leave it at that for a moment. But it might surprise you that we discovered a couple of things in our conversations in class. You know, one is it's not actually all that helpful to get a dictionary definition. So my students are like, Google, truth. Truth is something, something, a fact. And they're like, wait, let's look up fact. Fact is something, something that is true. And it was like, this is a big circle. So surprisingly, something as fundamental as truth, it's a little bit complicated. Number two, maybe following right on the heels of number one, not everyone agrees on what the word truth means. And number three, the truth and the fact, or the facts, are not at all the same thing. Isn't that funny? How can that be? Join me in my classroom someday to find out. But it certainly surprised me to learn that my definition of truth is almost exactly the opposite of many of my students. To some, facts are absolute, and truth is subject to personal opinion. Have you ever heard the phrase, my truth? Oh, that's your truth. This is my truth. I just, on a definition level, don't agree with that concept. But you'll see why in a minute. To me, truth is the one. Truth is like fact transcendent. It is unalienable. I don't know. Something even fancier than that. It's this concrete thing that whatever I think about it, it still is exactly what it is. I may have my opinions on the way the world works, but the truth will be the truth regardless of what I think. That's the way I see it. So let's investigate this phrase. What does this speak truth to power mean? Well, it seems to me, to suggest to me, that the big guys of this world, whoever they are twisted and corrupt and mean. The school bullies, if you will. And they really need the stiff little guy or girl to stand up and tell them what's what. It seems to me that it also suggests an idea that all it takes to topple power is truth. And I'll be honest with you, I've wrestled with this one. I mean, that's kind of the point here, right? Like, just sharing a bit of what my experience has led me to. I guess I find it a little frustrating the assumptions this phrase has. I won't bore you with the teacherly details, but I think about the way this violates something called Grice's Maxims. That you can Google, you will find it. So if I'm saying I'm the one speaking truth to power, does it not presume that I am truthful and you, whoever you are, my opponent, are not? And does it not presume that power is inherently wrong and worthy of opposition? The power itself becomes a crime. Right or wrong, sometimes I feel like when people refer to power, they mean someone who looks an awful lot like me. If you can relate, then I encourage you to join me in laying down your frustration. Okay, now let's investigate this a little bit through the lens of the Bible. What does the Word have to say about this concept? It might surprise you to know that there is exactly one person in the Bible, oh, be ready for interactive, it's coming up in 3, 2, 1, who said the phrase, what is truth? Who is it? Oh, look at that. Excellent student back there. I don't know if everybody heard any Pontius Pilate. You know when he said it? In response to Jesus. All right. This, I think, is so amazing. Here we go. So, firstly, I just want to point out, I find a phrase that I kind of want to take ownership of. Now hear me very importantly here, not to weaponize it, okay? Certainly not. Words really aren't meant to be weaponized. Least of all, the Word of God. That's not its purpose. To go bludgeon people with the Word of God. No, this is a book of compassion. So, we Christians, we need to turn our swords into plows, and I think that includes our words. James has something to say about the topic of what your words are like and what they can do. But still, who is the original of this phrase? Who is the first to speak truth to power? Perhaps it was Moses who said to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." Perhaps it was David who spoke to Goliath in 1 Samuel 17:45. "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." Or perhaps it was Jesus who spoke to Pontius Pilate, saying, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." That's John 18:37. And then Pontius Pilate, the expression of power over the land, responded to the way, the truth, and the life, saying, "What is truth?" Can you imagine that? What a beautiful gift that God gave us to see that moment. Here we have Pontius Pilate standing in front of truth himself, truth incarnate, saying, "What is truth?" Maybe this is a little bit what God means when he's like, "You can be totally blind, you know." And I feel bad for the guy. He had his shot. He literally asked truth himself, "What is truth?" But he wasn't ready to hear an answer. So what is truth? The answer is, of course, astoundingly simple. Jesus Christ is the truth. If we can know no other truth in life, then I humbly submit to you the final exam of life. God has given us the answer key. Just to throw in a little teacherly like there, you know, the motif of teacher. But seriously, God made it that simple for us. What a beautiful, beautiful gift. Because if it were any harder, we would have no hope. So, now, I want to show you one more biblical example of speaking truth to power. And this one is perhaps just a smidge more relatable. I mean, it's still obviously 2,000 years ago, but this is the new church. So as the church was beginning to blossom, these are the words recorded in Acts chapter 5. This is another one of those, like, I'm going to be there a little longer, so if you want to go to Acts chapter 5, you're welcome. Verse 27. "And when they had brought them, they set them before the council, and the high priest questioned them." So them being the apostles, you know, Peter, that crowd, they're speaking in Jerusalem at this time. The Jewish religious leadership had thought they had dealt with a problem. Jesus was gone. His disciples would go away. Annoyingly, they didn't. Annoyingly, now they're talking to all these people and they're saying they're different now, and we gotta stop this. And so, picking up in verse 28, saying, "We strictly charged you not to teach in his name. Yet here you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching, and you intend to bring the man's blood upon us." But Peter and the apostles answered, "We must obey God rather than men. The God of our fathers raised Jesus, whom you killed by hanging him on a tree. God exalted him at his right hand as leader and savior to give repentance to Israel and forgiveness of sins. And we are witnesses to these things. And so is the Holy Spirit, whom God has given to those who obey him." So, you know, just let yourself picture this. You just got arrested by some really angry people, and they take you into this room. They're probably sitting on some really high chairs or something. That, you know, you have to look up at them in order to answer them. Your hands are probably in chains, and they're really angry with you. And the thing you want to tell them is, "You guys killed God." How do you think they're going to take that? Why, in a sense, is it so important the way he said it, right? Why is it so important that Peter responded this way? It's kind of interesting. It's kind of like, Peter, don't you want to, like, maybe, like, calm things down a little bit? Don't you want to maybe be a little bit more polite? Now, I don't know about you, but I think this qualifies as speaking truth to power. And it sounds to me like Peter and the apostles are not speaking aggressively, just confidently. The fact of the matter is, this Jesus whom you killed, God has exalted for the forgiveness of sins. That's the truth, and it's important. And we know this because God said it, and God cannot lie. And those who were in power responded saying, "Oh, that makes perfect sense. Thanks for letting us know. Have a nice day." That is not at all how they responded. No, that's actually not what the word says. Rather, the next verse says, "When they heard this, they were enraged and wanted to kill them." Wow. Standing by the truth of God is certainly the right thing to do, but it likely won't win you any popularity contests. Don't be frustrated by this. Instead, I think the disciples gave us a beautiful example. Fast forward a couple verses, and we read in Acts chapter 5, verse 40. "And when they had called in the apostles, they beat them and charged them not to speak in the name of Jesus, and let them go." That about, you know, sounds normal. Verse 41. "Then they left the presence of the council rejoicing." You just got a beating. Yes! "That they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name." Wow. That's right. Take a beating and leave rejoicing. Why? Because they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name. I don't know about you, but when I first read that, that just floored me. I mean, seriously, who are these guys? That's some next level weirdo stuff. I hope that doesn't come off as too irreverent, but rather I do hope it's a little bit jarring, all right? I hope that it makes you wait. You're right. Nobody does that. Nobody takes a beating and says, "This is awesome." Superhero Christians aren't, as the modern phrase goes, here's just a little one for you, jacked. Muscular. No. Superhero Christians take a beating, and then they pray for their persecutors, that they might be saved by God. I want to be like that. And I think it's pretty fair to acknowledge, I don't know if I could do that right now. That's a pretty awesome standard, and it's most beautifully shown by Jesus himself. When he was being crucified on the cross, he cried out to the Father saying, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." Wow. I think sometimes after 2,000 years and however long you've lived and however long you've been exposed to Christianity and however long you've had the Bible in front of you, that sounds too normal. It's not normal at all. It is utterly astounding. And we need to just revel in that a little bit. How awesome is our God? Not just in power, but in every way. So I am in awe of our spiritual ancestors, and of course I am most in awe of Jesus. I want to be like him. Even though, in the world's eyes, that might just be a little bit weird. Or a lot. All right, I'm almost done here. And, oh good, see, this is good. I have about 5 minutes, according to that clock, and I'm circling towards home base. A little baseball metaphor for you. You know, Pastor Eric said you should talk sports when you're up here, too. So here's my last phrase for consideration, and this isn't so much as a phrase. This is not something I hear all the time, but I think maybe it ought to become one. And it's cited in Romans chapter 5, verse 6. It's just one verse, but look at this. For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. Take the verse as a whole, certainly, but I must admit that I'm particularly drawn to that little bit right in the middle. At the right time. it's tempting to me sometimes to look at this Christian life as one long pilgrimage, kind of, you know, Pilgrim's Progress-esque, which is a great book, by the way, filled with lots and lots and lots of scripture. Great book. Go read it. You can Google it because it's written 400 years ago. Where at the outset, we have this moment of divine flash, you know, all of our sin is washed away. And then a promise that eventually, when we die, most likely, we'll see God at the end. It's tempting to think that I'm doing my day-to-day all on my own. And unless I lift this world up on my shoulders, nothing will change. That's tempting. But that's also ridiculous. We are humans. We cannot save anybody. Do you have the power to forgive sins? I certainly don't. But at the right time, on the day of Pentecost, the Holy Spirit indwelled the hearts of man and lit the flame of the church. That flame still burns and will forevermore. Yes, be patient, brothers and sisters, for we have been given a book full of accounts of when God, at the right time, acted, doing something truly astounding. The most important is right in that verse, right? It happened 2,000 years ago. The most important thing in your life happened before you were born. At the right time, Christ died for the ungodly while we were still weak. But it's not the only at the right time. After many years, at the right time, God appeared to Moses in a burning bush. At the right time, he brought the Israelites into the promised land. At the right time, David became king and Solomon succeeded him. At the right time, the Israelites were cast into exile for 70 years. That's an odd at the right time if you think about it, but God did that at the right time. 70 years is like three generations. What if you were one of those exiles longing for home, but it was year 22? Okay, you have 48 more years to go. Keep going. At the right time, God will do what only God can do. And we must be prepared to be very patient. And I also think eagerly expectant. At the right time, in your life, God will do what only He can do. And at the right time, in the world, God will do what only God can do. So in the meantime, I think we should just prayerfully and faithfully do everything that we can do. For perhaps, at the right time, God will use you to do something of eternal importance. Something like extend the hand of the gospel to somebody who is very lost. And that concludes my sermon.